camel.
Yeah. I don't have anything this week. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You don't?
She was expecting the men to be
taken. Oh, she was expecting me to.
Well, no, I still read it, but.
Well, I didn't say you didn't read it.
I don't have anything either. But you can walk back here.
Did you see that at all, Randy?
See what? See what?
No.
He's quick. He doesn't.
Catches fire pretty quick, huh?
I think your translation was quite interesting, Your Eminence, in Romans, and how you laid out the offices. I thought that was very good.
Very, very good. We'll get into that in a few minutes. Gibrick Gora.
Well, there is so much, I'm not sure where to start, but anyway. Nazarene Coast Hill was phenomenal for me. In the notes that I read, the things that hit my mind while we were reading it. First of all, I saw that Adam was a picture of exile for the Jewish people, right? His Eminence talked about that, but I had written that down before class.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was exiled from the garden, which set the precedent for the Jewish people to be going to exile. And then, for God so loved, it said on the footnote, number 66 on page 42, it talked about, for God so loved the Gentile world that he sent his son into the world.
Mm-hmm.
The B'nai Israel and the Messiah as the Son of God. So God exiled the Jewish people to the nations so they could teach the Torah, which is the DNA of creation, to the Gentile world. As Adam was exiled from his supernal world in Gan Eden, so was Messiah exiled from his supernal world to be sent to the nations to teach the Torah. They have the same purpose.
Very good. Very good.
And then, page 44, footnotes 88 and 89, thinking about what the mystery is, as I read this page, I see all kinds of insights on the, number one, the importance of a married couple having a truly intimate sexual relationship. As a man delivers semen into the body as a medicine to the soul of the woman, when she has an orgasm, she releases the sin she's held on to him, because that's part of what the man is responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
So he's commanded to pray more to atone for the sins of the wife as well as himself.
Very good.
So that's why men who do not pray and then are intimate with their wives become overcome with sin.
Very good. Very good. We'll touch on some of that this evening, too.
And there's so much stuff to get this one.
Very good. Go on, Suriel.
Actually, she and I discussed that for quite a while, but I think the thing... Part of it was, after the end of my study today, was the faithfulness and the faith that Abraham had.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to do what he did, and I was trying to put it together, you know, with Isaac being the first and Yeshua being the second Messiah to be
Resurrected. Very good.
But it was an awesome study today.
Very good. Question. What's the difference between Yeshua's resurrection and Isaac's resurrection?
Didn't one take 3 days and the other 3.5 years?
No!
Okay, Adonai Joshua.
Well, you have the time frame. You have the fact that Isaac's resurrection was witnessed. And depending on your account, on which account you choose to believe, either by his father or by his wife. Then you have the fact that Isaac's resurrection was a regathering of his body from ashes, and that Yeshua's resurrection was a restoration of his soul to his body and amending of the body, but the body was still there. Have I already mentioned the time?
Yes.
that, well, those are the only differences on the face that I can see.
Okay, what about the fact that Yeshua resurrected and ascended directly into the heavens?
And that is where Isaac came from. He came from the heavens.
Yes, but he died again. Yeshua did not die. Right? Okay. Thumbs up.
So, coming over here to bit of this paragraph, I mean, it's from Ephesians 3, 1 through 4, and then it says, how is God's love administered if not through the halakha? And, you know, that you know me, at least on some level, to know that that would resonate with me pretty easily. And then also, I just lost the place in the commentary that I was looking at. The section, the little bit of commentary about the word from where we get economy, oikonomia,
mm-hmm.
and how, you know, it's a house of law, and that, you know, when I just look at it on the face, you know,
footnote number 65.
Right.
Kind of strengthens again the halakhic aspects, and I think a lot of times the halakhic aspects, even in the greater community, are sort of lost. I mean, they can be lost because, you know, so many of us don't look at halakha unless we're really into a certain way of looking at things or listening to certain teachers. We'll kind of lose that deeper aspect of halakha. You know, you just end up doing a halakha on a very surface level. You know, you do it because it's there and you know it's what you're supposed to do. And so it's just nice to always enjoy the fact that some of these things get into the deeper levels, which then can help me sometimes when I am struggling with certain things. And and I was even thinking about, based on what Gevorah Gevorah just said, that, you know, you look at the deeper aspects of that discussion, and if you're familiar with HaTikkun HaKlali, these psalms that you pray for rectifications regarding sins of the seed, if you will, it's a very powerful connection to what you what's in the commentary there regarding that aspect of a marriage. And then, you know, this is definitely a hidden thing to a lot of people in the Jewish world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm starting to encounter more people, though, as I've traveled around, who are honing in on these aspects. So it's kind of exciting in that way.
Mm-hmm. Looking at the bottom of page 41, a subtle allusion to the Pakidim here, which suggests as remnants of mysticism. Allegory, as that which is not Peshat, is more personified and working out of spiritual precepts, i.e. halakha, than Peshat, understanding the mitzvot. Please note that we are making an intentional distinction between the Peshat, the mitzvot, and the halakha, remnants. Okay, so you need to understand a mitzvah is a mitzvah. Okay, love your father, your mother, etc. That's a commandment, mitzvah. Okay, how that is worked out in different and varying situations, that's halakha. Okay, one is peshat, plain literal. We'll talk more about that, and then the other is remez, allegory. So very tricky, because one is literal and the other is not. But on Randy, your turn.
What got to me the most, one of the things, is on page 38 where you go and you say the fact is well established and need not to be expounded upon. And then right at the very end it says, can we fathom the depth of Abraham's trust in God? That stood out and just sort of like something dropped. Because when you go ahead and you read it all, you start to put things together because we're just not taught that.
Yeah. The difficulty is that it's kind of like our own Yoel and I were speaking the other night, and it's like, I guess it was our own Yehoshua, excuse me. With regards to who Yeshua's teacher was, from the school of Hillel, from that train of reasoning and thought, neither side wants to say anything about him. So little paragraph here, sentence there. Nobody wants to say it. Why? Because this side doesn't want to confess, because that means that he's Jewish. The other side doesn't want to confess because that means he's
Messiah.
Jewish.
Jewish.
No matter what you
look at.
Okay, but it is very, very interesting with regards to Abraham. And we've said, hopefully now, enough that everybody understands. My conclusion on the matter is that Abraham fully sacrificed the son. That is also His Eminence, Rabbi Yosef's, the Chacham, his opinion and view. So I'm sure that if you polled very many people, they would have many differing views. Okay, so that was something that I think is very difficult to understand, because I think that Abraham was fully aware. See, you know, some people don't want to, they want to talk about the ancients, or if you will, the patriarchs and the ancients, and they want to make them more or less intelligent than we are. That's a tremendous problem, because they were spiritual giants, and none of us are even capable of standing in their shadow in some respect. So, as I said in a commentary a week or two ago, Abraham, I believe, without any question, knew that Yitzhak would be gone for 3.5 years. And he knew exactly when Yitzhak would come back. And his knowing exactly when was behind him preparing Eliezer, his servant, in sending him for the bride that he would bring back. And I think that to say that that's not possible is actually very... to say that that's not possible is very, very demeaning to these men, because they were, in fact, spiritual giants.
Remnants. Does it say anywhere how long that Eliezer was gone?
No, it does not. To my knowledge, it'd be worth looking into some of the sources, but to my knowledge...
There was one place, if I remember right, maybe a couple places where... time was compressed, basically, and they were there very quickly, like in a day or something.
I know
sure
that
it was that this it, one or not.
Yeah, I know that it for sure relates to Jacob. So the sun was going down. He had traveled the distance. He's going to Bethel. Some are going to say that Bethel is Bethel, a different place that's south of Jerusalem. And then some say Bethel, which is what I say. Bethel is where the temple eventually was seated. So, okay. What I would like to do, I guess... Yes?
Gary.
Okay, go ahead. bring his volume up on that part, Cam.
Can you hear me? Is my volume okay?
No, your volume is way down, but we'll try to hear what you have to say.
Let me see if I can bring it up.
That sounds better, I think.
Well, I just raised him up.
Okay.
He has a problem with a
muffled. That is as high as I can go.
Okay.
When you were talking about the differences between Yeshua's and Isaac's death, resurrection, I don't know if I understood you correctly. Did you say that Yeshua did not die?
Second.
After he ascended, after he resurrected, he did not die.
Oh.
Yeah, he died, was resurrected, and then ascended into heaven alive. Not as Yitzhak, because Yitzhak dies, he's resurrected, and then he dies again. Yeshua does not die again. Okay? Does that clarify that?
Thank you very much.
No problem. All right. There's many, many things to say. I don't know how they will all be said, but we will work on them. Let's go to the book of Revelation. Well, the reason I started Revelation is so I don't start in Genesis every time.
Okay.
But I'll just hang on.
Just go ahead and stick your finger there.
I'll stay
since you know it's coming.
It's already marked.
First and the last.
It just opens today.
Very good.
And the first
sentence begins in the beginning. So. All right. For the sake of saying some things that perhaps those many of you listening via the internet have not heard me say, and rehearsing what you who are here have heard me say, in the Revelation, it starts out, and His Eminence and I were speaking and conversing on this the other morning, and it starts out the revelation of Yeshua HaMashiach, okay? Now, the apocalypse, the phraseology in Greek is the apocalypse, and the apocalypse is supposed to mean the revealing. So, of course, that means that in the book of Revelation, there's a revealing of Messiah. So it's so simple, everybody can write 25 commentaries on it, right? Many people have written many, many commentaries and still haven't been able to tell the difference between pork and
the symbolic
beef.
Book of symbols is difficult to...
Well, I was actually referring to the... Butcher, if you understand
right.
That. Now, one thing that you need to keep in your mind as we approach the text. I know that many of you are now studying Greek. You've been studying Hebrew, etc. And so, in a very short time, you will have some skills in Biblical Greek and some skills in Biblical Hebrew, which you may or may not already have. But I want you to understand something. I don't care if you are the best Greek grammarian in the world. I don't care. And you approach the text and you try to tell me, Walter, you've mistranslated, you've done this, you've done that, and you've taken the liberty here, and you've abused that there, and I'll say, you're absolutely right. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to continue to do exactly the same thing.
And you're going to turn around telling him, you did the same thing.
Exactly. So, what I'm trying to do, what I'm trying to say is that if you think Shalom Adon Scott, you may have to watch his microphone there. If you think that it's as simple as learning Greek or Hebrew, then you are totally misled. Because I wish it was that simple. I wish it was that simple. His Eminence will tell you immediately, which I absolutely agree, is that you cannot whether you read Hebrew or Greek or whatever in between, Swahili or whatever, it makes no difference what you know with regards to the language. You have to always understand the language from a cultural perspective. So I don't care if it's Greek or not, it's Greek dressed in a Hebrew dress, and it's Greek with a Hebrew culture behind it. If you forget those things when you approach the text, you'll never ever find what's being found in the text. You'll never find it. Because it takes a culture to understand what is being said in these materials. So when I approach the text, I'm not giving you some sort of a smoke and mirrors thing. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of repetitious mulling over in the mind, etc. If you're not willing to commit as much time as you can to the process, then you'll never achieve a true understanding of the text in the way that it's been intended. I'm not in any way putting any kind of stamp of approval on what I do. I am very fortunate that I run heavy equipment. That's my job. And I sometimes have hours and hours and hours where it's me, myself, and I, and all three of us are having a discussion, and all three of us are arguing with one another. I don't let that be known to
powers that be.
Yeah, because pretty soon, you know, you get a nice new white sports coat, long sleeves, and et cetera.
Yeah, now, give people pills for that.
Now. Yeah, yeah.
Where I've worked.
They still do.
Hopefully, you know, never mind. I don't want to go there. So, looking at the revelation, here there are some things that you must absolutely keep in mind when you approach this text. Number one, verse one. This is the apocalypse of Yeshua HaMashiach, the revealing of Yeshua HaMashiach, which God gave to him. Now, what you must know is this a revelation to whom?
Yeshua.
To Yeshua. To show his servants, Yeshua's Talmudim, things which must shortly take place. And he sent... And I always say it like this because I want you to realize what is being said in the text. He sent and he signified it. He put it in signs. This word in Greek is the word like simeon. It's a symbol where everything is in symbols. And he sent it by his ex-out angel because this is not an angel with wings, etc. This is one of the Old Testament prophets, the prophets from the Tanakh. We'll deal with that in a second. To his messenger, and his messenger gives it to Yochanan. Okay, so number one, reading the book of Revelation, this applies to any so-called book, so you might as well write it down that if you're going to look at John, you're going to look at the epistles of John, etc., everything is in signs and symbols, and it must be so decoded. Now, I'm going to say something else with regards to the revelation, and then I'm going to jump into trying to confuse you as thoroughly as I possibly can. Okay? So, if your head gets a little lightheaded, just hang in there. We'll land sooner or later. It'll fuzz back and forth. I've got to try to set that up so it fixes that. How many times have you seen me draw this circle on the board? Okay. So let's put here P for Peshat, S for Sa'od, R for Remez, and D for Drash. Okay? So now we've divided this out as we have done many times. I have said on many occasions
that the closest thing to sa'od is peshat, but also drash, okay? So the closest thing to peshat is remez, and remez is connected with drash, okay? Now, there's something very interesting that happens in this book. I have never heard this said. You've never heard this said, so you should write it down. The Revelation is a Sa'odic book written on a drash carrier. Okay? Now, what does that mean? When we talk about drash, we're talking about midrash, so it's an interpretive item, an interpretive piece of material, where the text is threshed, as it were. 32 rules of hermeneutic applied to them. But the thing that you can count on whenever you come to drash is always about the kingdom. Okay? And so you can now look at the book of Revelation and say it's so old on a drash carrier. So in other words, there's a narrative that's being played out. All the symbols in the book are Sa'odic, deep Sa'odic truths, but it's telling you how Yeshua, how Messiah, is bringing about the establishment of the kingdom, the governance of God. Now this is very, very interesting because when we say apocalypse or the revealing, that the amount of time that we're talking about all of a sudden is timeless. Right? Because when you enter into the spiritual dimension, there is no such thing as time. Time is only relative to this place that we're at. Now, that needs a lot of unpacking, but we'll leave it there. Okay? Revelation 1, and let's go to 20. Now, I'm skipping for the sake of time. You will read in the opening here. We'll just hit a couple of spots, and then we'll move on so that I can bring some other pieces of information into this as we work through it. Look at verse 8, said, I'm the Aleph and the Tav, the beginning and the end. It's very, very interesting, obviously, right? Who is, who was, and who is to come. I am, should be one of God's mighty men. He is not saying he is almighty, okay? Then he says and repeats this again in verse 11. He starts to talk about the seven ecclesia, the congregations. And then in the you see in verse 12, he said, I see and I spoke, and he said he saw someone in the midst of the seven golden menorot. Okay, so there's seven menorot, and it, obviously that is seven sevens, and I think you can start to count and say seven times seven is, etc., and you'll begin to see that some things with regards to that. It's not one lampstand, it's seven lampstands, and it's seven of them with the seven branches and on and on. Now, if you don't understand what a menorah is and you don't understand the intimate workings of the menorah, forget it. You'll never understand what is being said in these particular passages, okay? But always in Sa'odic materials, there are what we call keys, interpretive keys within the text, okay? I gave you one key and I said that it is entirely in Symbols. Simeon. It's in these symbols, and these symbols have to be unpacked, decoded, etc. So if you don't know anything about a bear, you don't know anything about a dog, you don't know anything about a cow, etc., now all of a sudden the symbologies that you need to understand, you need to go study these things, whether that means standing out in the field watching the cow or whatever, okay? You need to put some mental energy into understanding it. Verse 20, the mystery of the seven stars, which you need to just read the rest of this chapter. I'm hitting highlights right here. The mystery of the seven stars, which you saw in my right hand, and the seven golden menorot. The seven stars are the seven ministers of the seven congregations, and the seven menorot, which you saw, are seven congregations or seven churches. Okay? So now you have everything in the book of Revelation that you need for the interpretive process. Okay? Now, go back to chapter 1, verse 1. So this is a revelation of Yeshua HaMashiach that God gave to him to show to his servants, etc. So the opening text opens up now with speaking about Messiah. Okay? Everybody with me? Now what I say is that if you could take now this piece of Saotic material and look, and we said that it's close to Drash, close to the kingdom, what you will find as if the spiritual energy, as it were, is going in a counterclockwise motion, and that's because everything down here works on a clockwise motion. And so when we look up, you would think that it would go clockwise, but when you're looking down from above, which direction would you have to look? You have to go counterclockwise, okay? So we draw this from the spiritual or the heavenly perspective. Okay, so the energy is moving in a counterclockwise fashion. So what you're going to have as you come in a drosh, as you're studying drosh, you're going to have, as you move into Sa'od, you're going to have a remnant of drash in pieces and parts of the text. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? So the whole energy flowing starting here at Peshat, and you can do here this same thing in the same way we did that with each one of these, etc., and the energy is going to be moving in this direction as it moves in a counterclockwise direction. So we move from Peshat to Remez. There's always this little space where some of that goes over into the next level.
Call it bleed over.
It's kind of a bleed over, or however you want to say it. Okay, there's an influence of that that is resident in the transition. So the transition is not an abrupt transition where it's just all of a sudden cut off and then it moves to the next level. You have a smooth, easy transition to the next piece of material so that it can be seen and understood. Now, what you should also know is that wheels turn two ways, right? So you can actually look at this same process and you can see it going backwards in this way. And so you would see here Peshat influencing Sa'od, and then Sa'od influencing Drash, etc., all the way around. Everybody with me? Everybody says?
Yes.
That's obvious. Right?
No.
Now it's obvious. It wasn't obvious before, but now it's obvious, right? Now, questions before we go on.
And they never look at a pie the same way.
Yes. And they say pie all around, cake all square. That's all.
Or a Trivial Pursuit board.
You can see the same thing, though, like where you have the cusp of the zodiac, where you may be on Aquarius, but then when you reach the 21st or 22nd day, you're on a cusp of the next thing, and it's like it is a bleed over or a... It's like a mixture of kinetic energy between the two.
Is this part of what's in a symbolic way when we look at Ezekiel's wheel? Is this?
Do you ever play with a little gyro? What do they call it? Gyroscope.
Gyroscope.
When you're a kid, you know, it works kind of like a top. So you've got one piece inside spinning, but the other side's thing spinning as well. That's always the way I try to envision what is going on in Ezekiel's. But Ezekiel is.
I just keep thinking about the wheel inside the wheel.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I can see it.
It's interesting, though, it's always in the plural, wheels inside of wheels.
Right.
So, and that becomes obviously much more difficult. But yeah, you're doing right. One of the ways also to see it a little bit, you could do it a little bit, is, I heard this analogy, is a little bit like a bicycle wheel. You got two or three wheels inside that make a wheel, but etc. Okay. All right, everybody with me. So you understand that there's going to be some
remnants.
Yes.
I have a question.
Okay.
So you're saying with the wheel going both ways, the Peshat can bleed over into the Sa'od directly.
Yes.
Is this what you're saying?
Yes. Okay. And I'll make my point in a minute. Okay. Does that make sense? What I said, or is that something totally foreign? It's totally foreign. Okay, it's not his problem. It's not something that's openly discussed in our circles. Go to the Book of Mark. So we could say, in a manner of speaking, that we have a point of origin. And then this becomes, everybody got your picture of the wheel, and we'll probably refer to this, but I need to be more illustrated in other places.
We got to memorize, no problem.
Yeah, me too. If we have this wheel again and we have a point of origin, we can also look at it. See if I can do this very carefully. We can also look at this a little bit like a cube. And the, you know, inside, of course, it's going to go like this, etc. Inside, the top of it is a point of origin where the material flows in, and then it's got the different sides that it flows out, which our part is, again, right? Each side being one of the particular rabbinic levels. Okay, but let's call it right here. Let's say for a minute that this is the point of origin. And the energy is flowing, as we said, counterclockwise. If it's flowing counterclockwise, then it starts, the seminal point is at Peshat. And as the seminal point into Peshat, something's very wrong. Right? Because the seminal point,
it has to be
Sa'od. It has to take in so much of the possibilities of what can be said, that it has to be sawed, right? Wrong.
Well, I mean, if you have carryover, as we talked about, I mean, then it doesn't have to be locked into a certain spot.
Okay. If you understand the workings of the way that the tree works, it comes, the information comes in to the crown, it goes then to Chokhmah. From Chokhmah, it's restricted into Bina, etc. Okay, so the levels continuously restrict the flow of energy. If we look at this again, as that particular piece of pie, the most liberal piece that we have, or the piece that has the least amount of restrictions, is Peshat. The part that has the greatest amount of restriction is Sa'od.
I would think it'd be opposite.
I thought you would.
But there's more rules to Sa'od, and that's the whole reason why it's
restricted. That's exactly the case. There's 42 rules to Sa'od, making it more restrictive. So when you come to Sa'odic and spiritual materials, you have more hurdles to jump than you would if you're a Peshat. Okay? So now what I want to talk about is, again, this point of origin coming into Peshat, and then it possibly having some sort of Kabbalistic, and when I say Kabbalistic here, I'm moving into Sa'odic. Kabbalah is Kabbalah. Kabbalah means to receive. Okay, so Kabbalistic is that which is received. But the different levels, you can receive Peshat, you can receive Remez, Drash, and Sa'od. Okay, Mark 1:1. Paper up here. I need a couple more.
I was thinking along the lines, remnants of that effect comes from light, the graph that you have drawn. It's like a funnel, and it goes down. So the greatest light is at the top, but it has to be restricted down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand what you're saying, because you're absolutely right. But the deal is, it could go both ways, right? So, and that's the difficulty of trying to iron so many of these things down. You're right. It Sa'od would be the point, what we would seem to think, of the least resistance, whereas Peshat would be the most restrictive. The interesting thing, though, is that in some respects, Sa'od is simpler than Peshat, not in any way making it less mystical or Sa'odic. That's because exactly that. It comes in a symbol, and so I can give you five symbols, and then that's the end of that's the end of what you see. But now to unpack those symbols is the work, that's the difficult work, right? Okay, now you can look at Mark 1, but I'm going to read this particular translation is from His Eminence, and embellished a little bit here and there upon by myself, and then we will deal with another place in Mark in a minute. Okay, Mordecai, you should know that Mark in Hebrew, his name is Mordecai. Okay. So it begins with the word Reshit. And immediately that should be a flag, and the flag should make one think about the book of Genesis, because Genesis 1:1 opens with Bereshit. Okay? So, Reshit does not mean the first thing. Reshit means the most important thing, or the chief, or the most principal part of a thing. So it says, the chief part of the Masorah is Yeshua HaMashiach bin Ha'alikim, and as it is written in the prophets, behold, I send my messenger before your presence, which I will prepare your way before you. Okay? So, immediately, with the word Reshit, you should begin to think about Genesis, right? Now let's go to Genesis. Doesn't that sound like a wonderful idea? See, I could have just started with Genesis.
You have to begin
and
end, and you can go back to the beginning.
Very well said.
Okay.
Now, here we go again. And if you're not thoroughly confused by the end of the class, just let me know. We'll turn.
Have some personal time.
Jumble it up a little bit more so that you get more confused, right? Okay.
Does it have to be by the end of the class that we're thoroughly confused, or can it be somewhere in the middle?
It'll work in the middle, too. Okay.
It can bleed over?
It can bleed over, exactly. You're catching on real quick. Okay. Bereshit, in Genesis 1:1, Bereshit, Bor Elohim, Et Hashman, Et Haaretz, you should be very, very familiar with this. Now, this text, Bereshit in general, specifically about the first three or four chapters, have been the subject of more comments and debates and arguments than, you know, we could possibly list in a lifetime, right? And so, you know, the scientists are trying to figure out how that this is crammed into 6,000 years, and theologians are trying to say, well, couldn't have been 15 million years, and etc. I personally, I don't care about any of that. I know there are people that are very interested with those things. I'm interested in the message. What is being said in the message, okay? Now, one of the things that you should know is that the sages, the rabbis, the rabbinim say that the first 3 to 4 chapters of Bereshit cannot be read in a literal sense. It has to be read in a Saotic sense.
You said the first 4?
Yeah, 3 to 4, yeah. I could kind of slow down some more toward the ends of 3, but somewhere in that general ballpark. Now, what does that do to the theory that we've just posited with regards to all this business? We said that Hakam Safet, who is the author behind the Peshat text of Mordecai, starts with Reishit. Meaning that what he wants you to do is He wants you to go to Sefer Bereshit.
Because it is the most important, because it is what's first, or what...
Because it's a principle, etc. But what's happening here is that he's turning the material from Peshat. It's not Peshat what he wants you to see. It's deeply Saotic, right? If he's saying Bereshit, he's not just saying, look, we're going to start here because this is a good place to start, and you know, I want to connect all my dots and it's all good. But notice and understand, he says Bereshit, the chief or the most important part of the Masorah, which is the oral tradition of the rabbis, of Yeshua, etc. So then what he's speaking here is something that should tell us something about Genesis, what we're reading in Genesis. Okay, we've said last week, we said that from the opening first 4 or 5 verses, what you can do is you can interpret how that Adam had a fall. He has to fall, and it's written right here in these verses for you to do this. But I can go a little farther and say to you that it is absolutely imperative that Messiah would come, and I can read that from verse 1 and 2. I don't have to go beyond that. Walk in the park, right? But the problem that we have now is the fact that Peshat is taking up a Saotic piece of material. Are you with me? Okay? Now let's, you didn't know you can play Bible drill tonight, did you? Good. Go to John. Boy, somebody's having trouble, aren't they? Now, if you have read Acts more than once, you will know that something I've said in the past is that John is always hanging out with Peter all the time. He's running around with Hakamsafet. Why does the super Saudi guy, the mystery guy, what is he running around with the guy that's doing Peshawar all the time? You'd think that this guy should be isolated somewhere in a cave and then he, getting his revelation and saying, okay, I got this while I was locked up in the cave and nobody knew where I was at and on, right? Now, look at the text. John 1:1 says, in the beginning was the Word. And we can stop right there because we know now that what John did was he also connected to Sefer Bereishit. Mm-hmm. Or was he unlocking what was already stated in Peshat? So let's ask a question. Here we have Peter in Peshat making a connection to Bereishit, and he also makes it about Messiah. Okay? So he's telling you his content, his material content is going to be a revelation. Now listen, this is Peshat, is a revelation of Yeshua HaMashiach. Now what does that sound like? You could go back to the book of Revelation and say, this is a revelation of Yeshua HaMashiach. Well, what do you think Hakamsafet was trying to do? He's going to give you a revelation of Yeshua HaMashiach. Right? Okay, now you look at John and you say, in the beginning was the Logos, and you can understand immediately what he's trying to reveal. What's he trying to reveal?
Yeshua.
Messiah. All over. So this is about Messiah, and this is about Messiah. Okay? So we can say on one level, we can say that what Yochanan does is he brings a revelation of Sefer Bereishit, which I have no problem with that, because if you pay attention here, you'll watch this. Let's just go for a second. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was, etc. Said, and he was in the beginning. He repeats the phrase Bereishit. Now, with God, all things were made through him, etc. In him was life. Go down to verse 6. And this man was sent from God, then keep on going down to verse 8 and said, and he was not, or verse 7, he said, in the light, he speaks here about the light, and then he said the light was this, etc., on and on, right? So you know that these opening pieces are pieces that connect with Sefer Bereishit, but they don't just connect with Sefer Bereishit independent of the Peshat. They must rely on the Peshat because the Peshat is the point of entry, the point of origin for the materials that even Yochanan is talking about. Everybody thoroughly confused? Mark 1:1 again. The chief part of the Masorah, this is the oral tradition, is Yeshua HaMashiach. So he is saying that Messiah is a personification of the oral Torah. That means everything that's said about him, everything that he says, everything that the rabbis say, etc., etc. Okay? So the chief part of the Masorah is Yeshua HaMashiach, who has been Elohim. Okay? And you know in John 1 and 1, how long does it take him to connect to the idea of Elohim? Not very long, right? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with Elohim, and the Word was an Elohim. Uh-huh. Now, so what if we change the translation of Yohanan just a little bit so that you can begin to see the connection between the two pieces of material? Okay? Number one, I said, His Eminence wrote in Mark 1:1, you can write this down somewhere, the chief part of the Masorah is Yeshua HaMashiach. Okay? John 1:1. In the beginning was? No. The chief part or principle is the personification of the Torah. And the personification of the Torah was with Elohim the judge. Okay, so you can all of a sudden now see that what Yohanan is doing is he is borrowing from Hakam Safet. He is elaborating and unfolding what Hakam Safet is saying. Peter says, Yeshua is the chief part. He says the chief part is the Logos, but all he's doing is just saying Yeshua is the Logos. Right? But do a Google search of that and see how how that fares for you, because I'm going to tell you what, you'll be the rest of your life trying to figure all that out. Now, what I'm trying to show you is that we have been taught, even those of us who understand that there's more than one level of hermeneutic, we've been taught that, you know, hey, Peshat, it's all cakewalk. It's as easy as it gets. It doesn't get any easier than Peshat. And that's absolutely wrong. Because Peshat is the most spiritual law of all the texts. Because it has everything neatly packaged within inside of itself so that you can take a Kabbalist or a Saonic Kabbalist and come along and say, oh, yeah, I see what he's saying. And then he puts it in this spiritual jargon, and then everybody's mind gets dazed and confused and they can't understand it because he's using everything in just strictly symbols. Obviously, you understand that John, when he says the chief part of the Torah, he's speaking about he's not speaking about, you know, what's written on a page. He has no intention of you saying, oh yeah, all I have to do is open my book and I'll read it and I'll completely understand it. He has no intention of saying that whatsoever. The point that he's trying to make is that there's something here, as he says in the near end of his book, he said, I suppose that if all the world was filled with the activities of Yeshua or the Messiah, the world couldn't hold the books. You know why that is?
You can understand white fire.
Because the world is the book. The world absolutely is the book. The cosmos is the Torah. But Yeshua is the cosmos. No, the cosmos is the Torah. You can have an argument with yourself there if you're not careful.
So Wesley, if I may, Wesley wasn't so far off when he said, the world is my pulpit. Because in that way,
I make a pun in the coming commentary. God loves roses more than tulips. The the reason they're laughing is because they understand. You understand that the Calvinistic